most trusted and longest-running sports talk show in Tennessee. From the Budweiser studios of Cumulus Broadcasting, this is Sports Talk with John Wilkerson and Jimmy Hines on Sports Radio WNML.
Sports Talk. I'm John Wilkerson with Jimmy Hyams. A lot to bring you between now and the end of the program at 7 o'clock. But right now, it's your chance to win. It's the Sports Fix at 6. Jimmy, what's up for grabs this evening?
John, we're giving away a $25 gift card to Cineholic. Cineholic is, their mission is to solve everyone's dessert cravings. They are proud to serve a create your own cinnamon roll and other sweet treats. They're located at 9450 South North Shore Drive. $25 gift card to Cineholic if you can answer this trivia question. We talked yesterday about how Mike Shanahan is going into the Ring of Honor for the Denver Broncos for winning a couple of Super Bowls. Shanahan coached at two colleges that are on Tennessee's football schedule this fall. Name the two. Name the two colleges where Mike Shanahan coached that are on the Tennessee football schedule for this fall.
656-9900, 656-9900. Star 990 is free for AT&T and U.S. Cellular. Customers, the toll-free number, 1-866-656-9900. Let's start with Danny. Hello, Danny.
Hey, John. How you doing?
Doing well. How
good,
are
Danny.
You?
Good, Danny. How you doing, Jimmy?
Doing fine. I hope you are too, Danny.
If I can get this right, I will be. Two teams. I'm going to say South Carolina and Vanderbilt.
No, it's neither one.
Neither one. Okay, thank you.
Danny, we sure do appreciate it. Have a great night. Let's go next to Tom. You're on Sports Talk. Hello, Tom.
Hey, you said this coming schedule, right?
That's correct.
All right, Oklahoma and Missouri.
Oh, you half right. You started strong. Yep. Oklahoma was his first job. I think it was back in 1975. But you're half right on that, Tom.
Thanks.
Tom, we sure do appreciate it. Have a great night. It's Mark who joins us next. Hello, Mark.
Oh, goodness. I'd love to have this skipped. How are y'all tonight?
Doing well. Hope you are. Great to hear from you.
Okay. All right. I'm going to say Oklahoma and I'll just say Alabama.
It's not Alabama. Half right.
Okay. All right.
Mark, we sure do appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Let's go next to McKenzie. Hello, McKenzie.
Hey, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, Mike Shanahan coached at two colleges that are on Tennessee's schedule for this season. Name those two colleges.
Oklahoma and Auburn.
It is not Auburn.
McKenzie, thank you very much. Have a great night. Let's go next to Sean. You're on Sports Talk. Hello, Sean.
Hello.
Hi.
Let's go Oklahoma and the Florida Gators.
Yes, that is correct. Oklahoma
right.
And Florida are the two colleges on Tennessee's schedule at which Mike Shanahan previously coached. Hey, Sean, congratulations. You nailed it. You have won a 25.
I know I like my son better than him.
You do. Well, nothing wrong with that. Maybe you can send his son a $25 gift card to Cineholic.
There we go.
He might appreciate that. But
yeah.
That's what you have won. So congratulations to you. And we're going to put you on hold and get that prize to you. Good job, Sean.
Thank you.
Way to go, Sean. Hang on the line so we can get your prize information, and that takes care of the Sports Fix at 6. Jimmy, as you mentioned, his first job was as an offensive assistant at Oklahoma in 1975. He was the offensive coordinator at Florida from 1980 to 1983, so four seasons in Gainesville. But those are the two Tennessee opponents with which he has been on the staff, and that takes care of our Sports Fix at 6.
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember the Florida coach. Gosh, was it Charlie Pell? Maybe was there at that time. He's the one that got him in trouble.
Yeah, I believe that is the case.
I think he was the coach there that on that staff. They got that thing turned around in a hurry. They went like winless in 1979. Then the next thing you know, they were pretty darn good a few years later. They didn't go about it the right way, but they had a terrific team a few years later. And Florida was really outstanding in like 84 and 85. Of course, they got in trouble for that too. But they had some really good teams there. The great Tennessee.
It was Charlie Pell. It was all 4 years of Charlie Pell, and then Galen Hall, as you mentioned, for a couple for two seasons, and then Steve Spurrier eventually got in there and really did some big things.
He certainly did. But that Florida was outstanding in 83. I remember, or 82. I remember LSU going against them in a great football game at Florida. And Florida opened that season by beating like USC and Miami, and then LSU beat them. And then a few years later in 84, 85, they were terrific. That 85 team for Florida pinned Tennessee with its only loss that year. It was 17-10, I believe. And I think that may be the hottest game I've ever been to, because when I walked down to the field after the game, it was about 140 degrees, and you could see the heat waves up till about knee high or higher on the players. I'm like, I'd never seen anything like that. But I was worn out standing on the sideline late in the game. I couldn't imagine having to play on that turf in that heat. It was unbelievable. It was unbearable. But that was the only game the Tennessee team of 1985 lost, and that was to an outstanding Florida team.
We'll get a break. We've got more coming your way. To join us on Sports Talk, 656-9900, 656-9900. Star 990 is free for AT&T and U.S. Cellular customers. The toll-free number, 1-866-656-9900. This is Sports Talk on 99.1, The Sports Animal.
When special guests call in to 99.1, The Sports Animal, you hear them on the Stanley Fencing and Gates Hotline, stanleyfence.com.
Sports Talk continues. I'm John Wilkerson with Jimmy Hyams. And again, at 6:30, we will catch up with VFL Paul Anacone.
John, if you want to go see the Chicago Cubs play this season and you want to sit on the rooftop, it's going to cost you a little bit. Okay. And in fact, it's going to cost you up to $350 per ticket. That includes, you will be happy to know, food, drinks, wine, but $350 is what some of those tickets are going to go for. Beer, wine, and food is what you get. Now, a lot of those rooftops are owned by the Cubs. Some of them are privately owned. Chicago is allowing that, but only a 25% capacity for the rooftops. And some have already been sold, apparently, to some of the private owners of rooftops. And they usually go for about $150 to $300. So, gosh, that's a lot of money to pay to go watch a baseball game on top of a roof.
Well, I guess the fact that you have such a limited supply of home games this year compared to what is normally the case, and you don't know exactly whether or not you'll be allowed in Wrigley Field, that has not been established yet. I can see why you could the price would go up and the demand would still be strong.
And now you can get a discount.
Not that I would follow suit.
You get a discount if you go on Sunday. If you go on Sunday, $250. How about that? Down from $350. So, that's what the asking price is. And I'd be curious. I don't have any idea how many people can actually get on one of the rooftops. I don't know that. I don't know if the capacity is 20, 16, 24. What, I don't know what that is. But 25% capacity is what they're is what the city of Chicago has approved for the rooftops. So at least there's some folks in Wrigley Field already that are looking forward to baseball, because some have already purchased these tickets, according to the article I'm reading on ESPN.
Yeah. And you can, so you could either try and put that on your to-do list, or a field that includes North Carolina, Indiana, Texas, Providence, Stanford, Alabama, Davidson, and UNLV, the 2020 Maui Invitational. is, according to John Rothstein, is proceeding to be held as scheduled in Hawaii this fall.
Ooh.
Contingency plans obviously are being discussed if circumstances arise due to COVID-19 and the coronavirus. But right now, everything looks good for the Maui Invitational, which is normally that week that leads up to Thanksgiving.
Boy, I'd love to go back to Hawaii. That, I think covering that tournament or watching that tournament would be so much fun. Watch basketball and then go to the beach or go to wherever in Hawaii that you would want to go. I think that'd be phenomenal.
Yes.
Be a great trip.
I would agree.
So, San Francisco makes the Super Bowl, and one of the key players that got him there, running back Raheem Mostert, wants out. He's requested a trade, according to his agent, Brett Tesler. After months of unproductive contract talks, he wants to go somewhere else. His base is to be $2.575 million. And so he's looking to try to cash in and make a little bit more money than that. We'll see what kind of market there is out there. But it's $2.575 this season, $2.875 in 2021 is part of the three-year contract that he signed with the 49ers last year. So he signs the contract, and he wants a better deal after 1 year. Interesting.
Yeah. Gosh, I just to have been as close as you were to winning it all and to all of a sudden be so disenchanted with the organization that you want out, that just seems to me to be a very hard journey.
Well, he signed the three-year deal. Nobody forced him to. But he also now is their fourth highest paid running back. And there's a fullback that's making more than he is. But the other running backs, McKinnon is at 7.5. The fullback, Jusek, is at $5.25 million. And then Coleman is at 4.25. And he led the 49ers in rushing last year, 772 yards, 10 touchdowns. So he wants to cash in on that. And while he was a leading rusher, he's the fourth highest paid. And we'll see. It'll be interesting to see if he can land a spot. I don't know that he's going to be in great demand.
Mm-hmm.
He's a nice running back. He's got good speed, and it seemed like they used three or four running backs at San Francisco. I don't know that he's going to make a whole lot more money by going somewhere else. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that he would perhaps generate some interest, but I also think that he might be in the very best spot for him already. So you don't know what the market would be. I do think that he had some big moments, and I know that there were some games where he just didn't seem to be on the premises. I think the big play potential's there, but I think there are also peaks and valleys, significant peaks and valleys to his performance.
He was really good in the three playoff games. He had 336 yards, five touchdowns. He also set a San Francisco franchise record with 220 rushing yards in their NFC Championship game victory over Green Bay, where he was terrific in that game. So when you add all that up, he rushed for over 1,000 yards on the season, counting the playoff games. But, that'll be interesting to see what happens. As we know, a lot of folks in the NFL are not interested in paying running backs a ton of money unless you are among the elite. And I don't think that Mostert fits into that category, at least not at this time.
I would agree.
Yeah. John, you mentioned earlier Stanford eliminating 11 of its 36 varsity sports. We have seen other programs cutting sports from time to time. A number of sports. I don't know. I think Brown cut like 8 sports, and then they reinstated several of them, citing diversity. They wanted to bring those sports back to help with their diversity numbers. But 11 out of 36, that's a really high percentage. And I've got to think that if Stanford's doing that, that there are going to be some other Pac-12 programs not far behind. Because I don't think the Pac-12 is going to suffer financially. They don't have a great TV contract. The numbers for their – and I don't see them having many fans at games. So I think that of all the conferences out there, my projection is the Pac-12 is going to have more sports cut than any other conference.
Yeah, I think that you have the chance to be spot on with that projection and prediction. And like you said, they've struggled to put together a good and beneficial TV package. What they have is nowhere near what the SEC, ACC, or Big Ten has, even the Big 12 for that matter. So I think that it is an uphill climb for them. And you look at how many times that they haven't really even been a part. In fact, I think they've had a team be a part of the college football playoff, and that was Washington. I don't think anybody mm-hmm. else has made it, has they?
No, I think you're right. I think that's exactly right. And Washington had a really good team, but they didn't fare well in the college football playoff, if memory serves.
Yeah,
but
they drew Alabama, which was just not good.
No.
For the Huskies, because Alabama took care of its business.
Yeah. But I think you're going to see a number of them out there. I'm going to be curious. Now, a lot of Pac-12 schools field more sports, so it would make sense for them to cut more sports. I don't know that I think the SEC is going to cut a whole lot. First off, I don't know of anybody in the SEC that fields more than about 20 sports, nothing like the 36 that Stanford has. So right there, I think that you might cut some, but you're not going to cut many because you don't have that many to cut. So I don't think the SEC is going to suffer from losses of a lot of these Olympic sports like Stanford is doing. And now I also think, I may be wrong about this, but I think the conference that might field the next most sports might be the Big Ten out of the Power Five.
I think you're right. I think you are right. And so I do think that, I mean, there are a few SEC schools that have, for instance, I mean, if you were to look at sports that would be potential to be cut, I would just look at the teams or look at the schools that have sports that aren't SEC sanctioned sports. Rowing, of course, is at a handful of schools, including the University of Tennessee. Men's soccer would be another. You can go on. There are a few others that you have a rifle. I think. In fact, I don't know if there are a few schools that have rifle teams. For instance, Vanderbilt has bowling. I would look at those sports that aren't essentially SEC sports if there were any on the chopping block. But like you, I think when you look at the strength of the SEC network, what it means in terms of the revenue stream to the member institutions, I think they're perhaps in as good a shape as anybody to withstand projected revenue shortfalls as are expected with this academic year. And so, but we shall see. You never know. You have seen voluntary pay cuts that were taken, reductions in salary by athletic administrators as well as head coaches. So I do think that this is not to say they're free and clear of not feeling any of the impact, but I also think right now they're in a position to withstand it for perhaps this 1 year. And then if things don't get back to closer to normal or at least approaching normal, then you might see a further tightening of the belt.
Yeah, equestrian is another sport that comes to mind. South Carolina has that.
But that is an SEC sport. There is an SEC champion in equestrian.
Yeah, and I don't know how many teams in the SEC have equestrian.
Gosh, I think it might be six.
Okay, that's more than I thought. Yeah. I didn't have an idea about that. That also can be a pretty expensive sport when you think about the horses that you have to maintain. Another sport that's pretty expensive is gymnastics. Now, there are a lot of programs in the SEC that are pretty darn good in gymnastics, so I don't see that one going away. But it is one of the more expensive sports. Why? Insurance.
Oh, for sure. But they are, I mean, not everybody, as you mentioned, has gymnastics in the SEC, but it wasn't, I don't know that it was, I don't know what the case was this past year. But I know it was 2 years ago that every team, it was almost like softball, every team, every school that had a gymnastics team was in the NCAA tournament. So it's just another sport in which those that field it are very, very good at it or have put together great runs in competing with that. And the funny thing is about equestrian, you do have the upkeep of the horses at those schools. It's the other sports around the SEC that we sometimes wind up with just the backside of horses.
Yeah, that's a good point. I called up the number of equestrian The first article I saw said there were only four schools that carry it, but I'm not sure I'm going to continue
to
search that.
Well, then I might be
that.
Off on my recollection.
Yeah, all four SEC equestrian programs have won national championships at least once in the previous 6 years. Alabama's won two consecutive in three of the last four. So, hey, more national championships for the SEC. You know what? In the SEC, equestrian just means more.
Just means more.
It does. So
right.
That's the deal on equestrian that I have been able to find. But get back to our point. I don't think the SEC is going to be lopping off that many sports. There may be some along the way, but not very many. And, of course, we don't know what the financial damage is going to be this fall until we get through the football season and see how many games are played, if it's played, and what the numbers look like financially.
That's Jimmy Hyams. I'm John Wilkerson. We'll get a break. When we return, Paul Anacone, the VFL, joins us next on 99.1 The Sports Animal. Sports Talk continues. I'm John Wilkerson with Jimmy Hyams, and we head to the Stanley Fencing and Gates Hotline, Jimmy, for a very special guest.
Well, we do. It's Paul Anacone. Paul Anacone was an All-American at the University of Tennessee. He played on the pro circuit. He has coached some great players like Pete Sampras, Tim Henman, Roger Federer, Sloane Stephens, and right now working with Taylor Fritz. Paul, how you doing?
Good, guys. How you guys doing?
Well, we're doing fantastic. Tell us what's kept you busy with the Tennis Channel.
Yeah, it's been interesting times for us all, right? We're having to recreate things and kind of reinvent what we're doing. And in the meantime, for me, hopefully not drive my wife crazy. That's kind of my biggest goal. She's not used to having me around so much. But, no, we've been showing a few different exhibitions and some of the tennis communities trying to figure out ways to get some tennis going again. There's been a few different exhibitions around the country and a couple also over in Europe. Last week we did the All-American Challenge that was down in Atlanta and covered that. And now just waiting with fingers crossed to kind of see what happens with the tours, conversations about trying to open up again in August and to see what kind of plans they have in place.
Well, in the exhibition, and I watched your call of the Sam Querrey Tommy Paul match in Atlanta, limited fans. I didn't really see any bald people, although I saw a couple of them off to the side that weren't acting as they usually do in terms of retrieving balls. And I just wonder, is this kind of the new normal for tennis?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that I'm trying to do, and being an old-timer, I think it's hard for me to do it, but I'm trying to go into all this with an open mind, right? I mean, we look at the environment we're in, and you look at the options, and you look at the possibilities, and you kind of go, okay, do we listen to our science folks and see if we can figure out a different way to try to play for the time being, or do we not play? If there's a choice and you can play safely and our scientists and doctors can help us do that and we have protocols and procedures in place in case there is a positive test, then I'm for playing tennis and I'm for playing sports. I don't know about you guys, but I miss not being able to turn on the TV and seeing all different kinds of sports. So we've got to be smart. We've got to be prudent. But I think there are ways that a lot more smarter people than I can figure it out. But it may be the new norm for a while. Maybe a new norm for the while. I know a couple weeks ago the folks in Charleston put on a women's event that was terrific. You know, it's hard with no fans. You miss that feeling from the arena. You miss the atmosphere. But to see the ladies on the court in Charleston and see the guys on the court last week in Atlanta, I would vote for that over nothing for the time being. Yeah. And I don't believe in perfect. I think it's a moving target right now.
The U.S. Open scheduled for New York is supposed to be starting in late August. Do you think that there will be some big names that might elect not to play? I know that folks like Novak Djokovic is not decided. I'm not sure where Nadal is. But do you think there could be some big names that don't show?
Oh, yeah. I'll actually be very surprised if there isn't. I've got a lot of friends in Europe, and all they see is what they're seeing on the news, right? They're seeing a lot of spiking numbers and a lot of scary times in some of our states. I think New York is actually doing pretty darn well. They got slammed right at the beginning, but they seem to be trending in a really good direction and trying to use all they can to figure out ways to get sports going. But I think most of our European friends just see our country as a whole, and they see all of these different areas that have these huge hot spots. So there's a lot of very kind of nervous folks from across the pond that wonder whether or not they should come over. So I'll be surprised if there are not some missing big names.
Paul, it's good to talk to you again, and sure hope that everybody remains safe and sound in your neck of the woods.
Well, that's the goal. That's what we're trying to do. Everyone's trying to get used to our new reality and do the best we can and see if we can stay safe and take care of each other and have some patience and perseverance.
With what we've seen in terms of some of the pushback, for instance, I think it was that we heard from Djokovic and Nadal that they weren't up for all that would be required for the U.S. Open, and as you and Jimmy were talking about, but also what do you think in terms of the reaction for the goodwill tour, essentially, that Djokovic was trying to put together in Europe, where you had a handful of players that tested positive, and he has really been taken to task for trying to make that happen, because at times he was shown to be not social distancing and partying and doing different things like that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it's kind of a shame, because I think that you know, it was all for good intentions. You know, this was a very much of a mission of from Novak's heart. He wanted to be philanthropic, wanted to help his home country and a lot of the folks over there and raise some revenues for some very good causes. And, you know, Serbia had, their government had lifted all of the restrictions. I got to say, when I turned on the TV and saw it, I kind of commentated holding my breath, if that's possible. You know, to see the players on the court was great, but I was so nervous because there wasn't any social distancing at all, and there was nothing done in the stands, and the stands were packed. So I was very nervous, and look, it was really sad for me to see it all come together like that, because I know Novak was trying to do it for the right reason. But boy, we are really behind the eight ball from the start with this COVID-19, and we can't take anything for granted. I think the young athletes are in positions where it's very unlikely that they'll be seriously ill, but it's very dangerous, and even our experts don't really know yet. So I think that's why ever since then you're seeing a lot of people take a lot of precautions to see if there's a way to kind of go up the staircase. And that's how I look at it. I think that the Adria Tour there kind of went from the bottom stair all the way to the top stair. And we need to go kind of one step at a time and figure out protocols and procedures to make it as safe as possible. And nothing's going to be perfect. And then figure out if people do get COVID-19 and they're there playing, how are we going to manage that? What does that look like? And do we keep playing? Where do we cut it off? And how does it work? So it is a very multi-pronged approach, and I think the powers that be are trying to figure that out now and learn from the mistakes that all of us are making.
When you look at the top players in the world and what they are used to having on hand at their disposal, as well as resources, you can quickly exceed what has been suggested to be a minimal representation. As for instance, when we see the bubble in Orlando for the NBA, you know that it's greatly reduced the amount of support staff that's going to be there. But when you're a tennis player and you count on having a coach and perhaps a physical therapist and or trainer or a nutritionist or just your team that travels with you from one location to the next, how difficult do you think that is to adjust to if you're just used to having a certain amount of people on hand with you when you go to a tournament?
I think it's going to be tough for the top players, especially because they're, you know, they're generally the ones with the teams. Most of the other players have a coach. Some of them have a coach in physio. So I think it's going to be very difficult for the top players. We'll see where it ends up. The other thing, guys, that's going to be so bizarre, picture Novak Djokovic playing on center court against Sam Querrey with, I don't know, 30 people milling around watching at Arthur Ashe Stadium. That's going to be really bizarre. So I think that there's so many things to think about, and I don't think there is an answer. It's a matter of trying to figure out how malleable we all can be. But I think the lack of having a big team is mostly a top player issue. But look, it's a new horizon out there for everybody. So we're going to have to try to figure out how to make the best of a horrible situation.
Our guest, Paul Anacone. Paul, because tennis is such a global sport, do you think it has been impacted more than many other sports?
I think so. And it's so funny because all my friends outside of tennis said, oh, you're going to be great, individual sport and two players, that's it. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds great once you get them on the court, but explain to me how you get top 100 players from 47 different countries around the world to get through all these different borders and to be okay and to keep things quarantined and to keep the COVID under control. There's 47 different countries represented between the top 100 players on the men's and women's tour. That is a very complicated spider web to deal with.
Mm. Do you think that that the U.S. Open will watch closely the two tournaments that precede it, the City Open in Washington, and then the Western and Southern Open in New York? Do you think the U.S. Open will watch closely at how those sports are operate?
Yeah, they will, and they'll work hand in hand. I mean, they are the owner of the Cincinnati event, and it's going to be played at Arthur Ashe Stadium. So they will be putting that together, and I know that they're working hand in hand with the ATP and WTA tours to come up with procedures and protocols that make the most sense. I think what's going to be interesting, because next week team tennis starts, and we're going to have team tennis in Greenbrier in West Virginia, and they're going to have a bubble very similar like the NBA is doing. They're going to play all the team tennis at the Greenbrier Resort, and I'll be very curious to see how that plays out, and I'm sure the USTA and the WTA and the ATP are going to be looking with bated breath to see how that all works. But look, my big thing is if we think that sporting events are going to happen and there's not going to be any COVID cases with these athletes, then we probably shouldn't have them, because there are going to be COVID cases right now. Every time we see this, it really happens. Charleston did a great job. They had zero COVID cases. They had no fans. The players in the tournament did such a tremendous job. No one got sick. But I think the idea is to think about Washington, D.C., think about the U.S. Open, Cincinnati, and you're talking about a few hundred people, a few hundred players, just players alone showing up. That kind of a crowd showing up, coming in from all over the world, I can't imagine we're not going to have a few cases. So if that's the case, what's the protocol? What's an accepted number of cases to have? And if there is no accepted number, then everyone's got to take a deep breath and really think about whether or not we should play.
The challenge, of course, is getting back into the swing of things, literally and figuratively. What do you think have been the biggest challenges? No doubt we've seen Major League Baseball players at times struggle to have someone just to play catch with when it comes to
sure.
tennis. What do you think the biggest challenges have been for those that have been on the shelf since the middle of March?
Well, as an athlete, and you mentioned Taylor Fritz. I've been trying to help him and for a long time, and through these times, I think it's really challenging because until recently, the players haven't had a starting line, so that they don't know really when they're starting up again. So initially it was, how long should I take off before I get going again? And I think depending on the stage of the player's career, the older players with more experience will use most of this time to get as rested and recovered and energized as possible. And for the younger players, I think it's an amazing opportunity to try to get better, to really work on things. So I think there are a couple different signs to try to deal with, but I just think it's each person's going to have different hurdles to jump over. But initially it was that, okay, when do we start up again, and how do I periodize my preparation so I'm ready to go?
while we have been waiting for, as you mentioned, the start line and when to perhaps circle the calendar to see when tennis would return, one thing, unfortunately, we found out is that 2020 was not going to see Roger Federer again, as he had another procedure done on a knee. And can you tell us how he's doing, and what is it like to see Roger Federer closing in on what will be the ultimate finish line for his career?
Yeah, it's probably been 10 days, 2 weeks since we've been in touch, and he seems in good spirits. He's spending a lot of time with his family, and I think the procedure went well, and based on everything, you know, that's gone on and all of the who knows what's going to happen, he kind of thought, you know, let me take a deep breath and just take this time and try to really get ready to go so that if things are good in 2021, I'm healthy, I'm fit, I've got a full fuel tank mentally and physically, and I can get going. Look, it's just so amazing to think it closing in now on 39 years of age, he's still in the top five of the world. And it's just, for me, I don't even know what to say about it. It's just, I have a big cliche that I always say, which is don't bet against great, because they're just different. You know, all these great athletes do things that it's hard for us to comprehend. And I think Roger's love for the game and his desire to be out on the tennis court is what fuels his fire. He loves to be a citizen of the world. He loves the game that he competes at. And he truly cherishes bringing his family around the world to see all the wonderful spots on this globe that we have.
So, Paul, while you're not betting against Federer, would you bet that he would win another major?
Well, for me, I would say it's very difficult to say there's no way he can. 12 mm-hmm. months ago, he had 2 match points in the finals of Wimbledon. And I still think on grass courts, when he plays well, he is one of the toughest guys to beat in the world. And he showed us that 12 months ago. What I don't know, and what's really difficult, and this is probably a great question for a strength and conditioning and a sports scientist, is at what stage do you start to deteriorate in terms of the difference between taking a break and letting your body recover and taking so much time that your skills start to dwindle? I don't know that answer, but I just know the older you get, the harder it is to sustain a high level. You can still have great days, but it's tough to have great 2 weeks, great months, great entire years. So that's going to be the challenge. But that being said, you know, Roger, can he put together 2 weeks and be in the finals of a major again and give himself another chance? I'm not betting against him.
Yeah. I think we've been blessed to see three all-time greats, Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal, Novak Djokovic. When all is said and done, Paul, who is going to end up with the most majors out of that threesome?
Well, if everybody stays healthy as long as they should and the tour returns to normal, I would think that Novak's going to finish with the most. That would be my guess, just because he's got more years left in his prime. I think Rafa will probably win the French Open for another 10, 15 years, probably, based on what we've seen. But I just think Novak is still at the top of his game, the top of his talents. Who knows what's going to happen mentally, physically, and emotionally? Will he get tired? Will he have had enough? Will he want to just settle down with his family? So many things happen at this stage of the career. But when you look at the macro, and, you know, Novak is this close right now, and he's the youngest by a decent amount, I would say he has the highest likelihood of winning multiple majors down the road. So I give him a slight edge.
Do you think that he will go down as the greatest tennis player ever, Djokovic?
You know, I always have this conversation with folks, and I try to steer clear of it, not because I want to be on a fence, but just because I kind of feel, in a strange way, it's almost unfair to compare eras, because I feel like, you know, people, when Pete was winning everything and saying he was the greatest of all time, I was like, well, what about Rod Laver, won 2 Grand Slams? And when you watch it on TV, the game was very different. But if Rod Laver was in this era with his mindset, with his skill set, I'd be hard-pressed to imagine that he wouldn't be a great player. So what would he do in this era? So I always feel like it's the most accomplished instead of the greatest. I would say that, like I just said before, Novak probably will be the most accomplished in terms of major titles. That is my guess. As far as the greatest goes, I want to let all the pundits and everyone else just argue about it, and I'll just sit back with a, a nice beverage, and I'll watch all the great players and appreciate what they've done.
Paul, how excited are you to see the U.S. Open in New York to get that going in late August?
I'm really interested to see. You know, I just want to try to go into it with a really open mind and expect it's going to be very different, expect there's probably not going to be all of the top players, and I want to see what the USTA and I want to see what all the folks that have their thinking caps on come up with, and I want to try to be flexible in terms of passing judgment because I think we have to expect it's going to be very different. But I am a huge tennis fan, and I will love to see tennis if it's played at the Billie Jean King National Tennis Center at the end of August.
I hope we do have it. Hey, Paul, thank you so much. I really do appreciate your time. I know how busy you are, and thank you for visiting with us to talk about tennis.
Guys, it's always a pleasure. You guys take care of yourselves, and look forward to having a good rest of the summer, and go Vols!
All right, thank you, Paul. Thank you.
Appreciate
that. See you guys. Bye.
See you, Paul. Thanks. That's a great Paul Anacone. By the way, he's got a couple of kids, Olivia and Nicholas, that when he talked about his family earlier. But comments from Paul Anacone and saying that he thinks Novak Djokovic will end up with the most majors. That makes sense, given the age. It certainly does. I would see that. But as long as Nadal is playing in the French Open, it's kind of hard to not chalk another one up for him. But as I mentioned earlier, John, I think we're just blessed to see three of the all-time greats playing at the same time.
I agree 100%. And you wonder whether or not Djokovic is going to be able to close quickly, because at some point, even though you don't bet against great, Federer will have played his last match. And Nadal, again, I think that he would probably have already caught and passed Federer if he had not battled as much injury as he has. But I just wonder who's going to be the next great competitor or competitors for Djokovic, because I don't think it'll be that long comparatively before he is essentially the last man standing out of that trio.
Yeah, see, I think that's exactly right. And we talked about this earlier. Nadal has missed 9 majors. He has some health issues. Federer has only missed 4. He was an Iron Man until about 2016 when an injury knocked him out. But I don't see anybody coming up that I think is a surefire guy that's going to challenge him. Maybe it's Dominic Thiem. Maybe. Mm-hmm. I think he's got a lot of game. Maybe it's a 6'11 Riley Opelka that bombs the serves. So I think there's some other candidates out there, but none of them yet strike me as having the ability to string along and garner a whole bunch of majors like what Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic have done. So we'll see. But the good news is that hopefully we'll have the U.S. Open in New York in late August, and I'm looking forward to that return to tennis, provided they are able to play.
That's Jimmy Hyams. I'm John Wilkerson. We'll get a break and be back to close out today's edition of Sports Talk as you listen to 99.1 The Sports Animal.
Not so much our job as it is our obsession. 99.1 The Sports Animal.
Final segment to today's edition of Sports Talk. I'm John Wilkerson with Jimmy Hyams.
John, let's hear from Greg Sankey, a couple of comments. He was on with Rich Eisen with ESPN, and we've talked earlier today about the Ivy League not having any fall sports, about Stanford dropping 11 sports, and other impacts around the country. Here's Sankey talking about the financial impact of college football.
Well, my focus has been communicated on playing football as scheduled, but the real answer to that question is the circumstances around the virus are going to guide us. And kind of the background of the observations made is the financial issue.
Yes.
So unspoken in your question, but in the articles that inform the question as well, you know, there's total collapse. We stopped our spring, which has an economic reality, but we made the decision around the health of the participants. We're going to have to learn to live with COVID, if you will. That doesn't mean we're going to make rash or inappropriate decisions. We're going to involve our medical leaders, those who work in infectious disease to help guide us. And that is what will inform the decision. The reality, and we're seeing in our economy every day, that when you disrupt the activity on which an enterprise is based, that has implications. And all of us have a responsibility to think through those hypotheticals. But at the end of the day, we want to play football. I believe our participants want to play football. Our soccer players want to participate in soccer. Our basketball players want those opportunities. But we're going to take the appropriate approach. We're going to exercise the right level of care, just as we're doing now. We want our players to be safe on and off the field, and then we want them to take personal responsibility to be safe in their own lives. That will help us participate in football, and to the extent we have to adapt and adopt plans, I think all of us are prepared to do so, but with the focus on health, the ability to play safely, and support the right kind of competition.
And other colleagues of yours at the commissioner level have said if a school does not have on-campus learning, that if students are not invited back on campus because of COVID-related activities, there will be no games. Is that your philosophy as well, Greg Sankey?
I've never said that. What I've said is our universities have to return to operation. That's a threshold, and that's happening across our conference and in many ways across the country. There will be some variance, as we know. This fall semester may not look like last fall semester. That's reality. And how that manifests itself is still part of that planning process, I think, taking place on every campus. And in fact, the learning about public health issues that are emerging during the summertime, I think, help inform the level of decision making that will be needed. So when you look at our universities, we have some that will have in-person classes during the summertime, not the same offerings they had in the second session, for example, last summer, but still have on-campus classes. That'll be both the learning experience for everyone, but is part of how I explained we got to be back in some kind of operating mode.
Comments from Greg Sankey, SEC commissioner. So it is going to be interesting to see what happens. Obviously, a tremendous financial impact on college athletic departments if we don't have college football. Tremendous impact on universities that also benefit greatly from the revenues that are derived from college football. Also, the communities, the restaurants, the motels, the bars, so forth. So hopefully we can get to a decent number in getting the cases down to where we can play college football this fall.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that here's hoping that things get on a good path. But there's a lot that has to happen to be in that safe zone, just from an individual and they're taking care of their business, their responsibilities in that regard. Yeah. So I very much hope the same. And it is something to hear that, yeah, all plans are still moving in that direction. Question is whether or not we get to stay in that direction.
I know a lot of people don't want to be told what to do, and that's fine and understand that. But just be responsible. If you're in a situation, just make sure that you social distance, that when needed you wear a mask. Just do the appropriate things to help cut down on the number of COVID cases that we have.
Jimmy, have a great night.
John, you too.
Sure to appreciate it. Stay tuned, as up next, it's the Starting 11. Thanks for listening to Sports Talk.